My name is Howard, and I'm an I'm glad to be here. It's an honor to be asked. Actually, my name is Howard Poland, and my name within AA, I don't want it to be anonymous. What's anonymous is where I live. I have lived in the Southern California area. In fact, I'm a native of Southern California for most of my life. And I have been traveling back and forth between Los Angeles and San Diego and Phoenix for a number of years. Several months ago, I moved to Chandler, Arizona, which has really caused me a lot of confusion. I was invited to speak in Paso Robles, California, and the flyer in Paso Robles said, Howard P. Chandler from Arizona. Here it says Howard P. from Oceanside, California, where I haven't lived for quite a while. I'll tell you this, I have gotten used to the heat over here. I'm acclimated now to the heat. The last time I went to Culver City and I got off of the airplane, the ocean breeze hit me and I fainted. And they had to throw two buckets of hot sand in my face to bring me around. So, I'm going to watch my watch for those of you that are worried about that. That doesn't mean I'm going to stop in an hour. It just means I'm going to know how far I've run over when the time is. For the newcomers, speakers in AA are not authorities. The authority in Alcoholics Anonymous is, in fact, the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. In order to add credibility to my talk, I make up stuff and say that it's in the big book. And I give page numbers for it. And nobody ever checks. They say he's not much of a speaker, but he sure knows the book, doesn't he? There's a story I heard after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, which I am, I'm as obsessive about telling this story as I was about drinking. The obsession is somewhat different now. I do not expect it to be different. My obsession when I was drinking was that somehow, some way, this time it's going to be different. Don't you believe it? This story is going to be the same as I've always told it. And this story involves the training of a baby elephant, which they start out by chaining the baby elephant to a tree, its right front foot chained to a tree. And it fights the chain and fights it and fights it until it comes to believe, without knowing that it comes to believe, that when the chain's tight, it's futile to pull against the chain. And it stops fighting the chain. And when the trainer sees that it's no longer fighting a chain, they go on with the rest of the training. But for the rest of the elephant's life, in order to hobble it, they put a chain around its right front foot and drive a relatively short stake deep enough into the ground that when they put the chain on it, the chain will get tight. And the elephant ultimately is strong enough to pull a locomotive. But he won't pull against the tight chain because when he was a baby, he learned that limiting belief. And he doesn't know he knows it, and he has no way of examining his belief system, so he's stuck with that. When I heard that story, I knew that I had come to Alcoholics Anonymous with 572,344 baby elephant beliefs just like that. stuff that I had learned, which may have been true when you're 2 or 3 years old, but is no longer true when you're in your 35s, but I was living it like it was true. It was stuff that I learned that I didn't know that I learned, stuff that I believed that I didn't know I believed. I was born in Alhambra, California, but I was raised in a small farm community near Wichita, Kansas. And back there, during wheat harvest, in the Methodist Church, you pray for it not to rain during harvest so that they can cut the crop and get it in. After harvest, you pray for it to rain so that they can disk and plow and sow next year's crop. Now, sometimes when we pray for it not to rain, it rained to beat hell. Other times when we pray for it to rain, sometimes we had long droughts and it didn't rain for weeks and months. And so we prayed more. And nobody ever singled me out to blame me. But I always knew that I was basically responsible. That it was my fault because there were a whole bunch of things that you had to be doing that I wasn't doing, and in order to get your prayers answered. And I always felt guilty about the damn weather. I didn't feel good about that. Another thing I learned that I didn't know I learned was that God was up in heaven. God was an anthropomorphic being, another man behind the pearly gates on the streets of gold that, just like any one of us now has a vague idea of what's going on at our homes, God had that kind of a big idea about what was going on every place. And the only direct connection that I had with God was in fact an indirect connection through a series of tattletale angels that were flitting back and forth, monitoring my behavior, taking the bad news upstairs where they were keeping this big book, a record, and they kept score. And I was behind and I wasn't catching up. And my only hope of ever having a direct contact with God was after I was dead, and that hope was perilously close to zero. And the alternative was to be zapped forever. And I didn't get a hell of a lot of spiritual strength out of that. I didn't feel good about that. Now, my dad was an alcoholic. And my dad was, we're a German family. And grandma and grandpa had 6 or 7 kids. And they were wonderful parents. My grandpa, though, once said that he loved grandma so much that he almost told her. And there was a lot of that in my dad, you know. He was somehow afraid to tell you that he loved you, if he did. But he had no compunction at all about telling you when he didn't. And he'd also whip you. And when he was whipping you, he'd tell you to shut up. And if you didn't shut up, he'd whip you until you did shut up. And that went on for quite a while sometimes. Now that didn't make me an alcoholic. I think it caused some conflict. And I could never resolve conflict. I never got where I liked the whippings. And there are people that do. I understand that a lot of them are in West Hollywood. I never got where I liked that, and I never felt good about that. I didn't feel good as a son. I didn't feel good as a brother. I didn't feel good as a student in school. I sure as hell didn't feel good in church. The fact of the matter is, and I know this isn't unique to me, I hear it all the time in meetings, I just didn't feel good. And when I was 13 years old, I drank a quarter of a pint of Bourbon Supreme. And when that was half gone, I felt good. And I knew what it was to feel good for the first time. I just sat there and soaked that good feeling up. And I got sick. And next chance I got, I knew I was going to drink again. I also knew that I would get in trouble if my dad found out, but I knew I was going to drink again. I knew that I had never felt good, ever felt good like that before, and that was magic. Now, my wife and I met in the seventh grade, and there were 21 of us in this class, and we went through junior high and high school together, and I was 20 when we got married. And we were married 19 years when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife is not an alcoholic, but she needed Al-Anon when we were in the seventh grade. And she isn't... Is this really on tape? Well, she don't ever listen to it anyway. But I'll tell you about my wife. Also, when we were in the seventh grade and something good happened in her life, she felt good. She had good feelings on the match. She also had bad feelings. And I didn't understand that until after I had come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought she was phony, that you can't feel good naturally. Well, there's a whole world of people that feel good from time to time naturally. But we aren't among those. And how I know that is, in the big book, on Roman numeral page 26, it says that alcoholic, essentially says, alcoholic men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. They like that good feeling. But that sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is somewhat injurious, they cannot after a while differentiate the true from the false. And their alcoholic way of life becomes the only real way of life. True to the point that I could sit in this bar that I went to called the Tattletail, a real pond scum place, you know, and nothing but lower companions. And after three or four doubles, I could sit there and think that the people that are missing this don't know what life is all about. The alcoholic way of life becomes the only real way of life. And it says we feel restless, irritable, and discontented until we can once again experience that sense of ease and comfort that comes from just taking a few drinks. To say I felt restless, irritable, and discontented, you know, those were my good days. You know, and that was true from the very start. I was always, you know, from a state of low-grade alert right up to immobilizing anxiety. And I was as angry as a scalded rattlesnake. I just couldn't handle it, you know. I knew that I could once again experience that sense of ease and comfort by just taking a few drinks. And I would have those few drinks, And then what the book describes as a phenomenon of craving would set in. I never thought on it, you know, it wasn't a phenomenon of craving. What it was I would change my mind and decide to have more than a few drinks. Very simple. I never drank like an alcoholic. I sipped my drinks. Except for when I gulped them. And it, you know. The phenomenon of craving would develop and I'd go through the well-known stages of a spree. I would emerge remorseful with a firm resolve not to do that again. Then the book says we do that again. And again, and again, and again, and again. Then the bad news. Unless this person can experience a complete psychic change, there's very little hope for his recovery. The psychic change is what they use, you know, that's the doctor's opinion. The rest of the big book's opinion is it's a spiritual awakening. And unfortunately, that was to elude me. You know, who needs a spiritual awakening as long as you can have a half a pint of Old Crow? Who needs faith? Who needs serenity? Who needs any of that stuff as long as you can have a half a pint of Old Crow? And a few guineas. I heard a guy say that, a guy named Colin, we call him Serenity Sam. He said he came to Alcoholics Anonymous with a Benzedrine mouth and a Demerol brain. I never had Demerol, but I understand the problem. Anyway, over any considerable period of time, alcoholism gets worse. It never gets better, and that was certainly my experience. And that was my drunk a lot. I drank because I liked the effect produced by alcohol. And I could not differentiate the true from the false. And if I didn't drink, I was immobilized. I'd get a work assignment, and I just didn't know which way to turn with it. I knew I couldn't do it, and as soon as I knew that, then it would really grind down, you know. And the fear would build on the fear, and I would be completely out of it. And I knew that if I just had a few drinks, that I could get my heart started and get my brain to work, and I could make it work. And I did. And you know, that worked. That worked well for some period of time. It worked well enough for a long enough period of time that through the rest of my drinking, which was terrible, I was obsessed with the idea that somehow, some way, this time, I'm just going to drink this half a pint. I'm going to drink just enough of it to get my brain working because I was hungover. Now, when I was a baby elephant, I learned that alcoholics were people that drank in the morning. And I knew that all my life, right up until the morning I drank. And then I didn't know it anymore. I didn't know why alcoholics drank in the morning. But I drank in the morning because it was the only way to get rid of a hangover. It didn't have anything to do with alcoholism. My sponsor, who's a terrific, wonderful man, he's an ex-Catholic priest. He found his own program right before he left the church. And he has involved drinking also, so he's an ex-priest. And he can see that he was a social drinker to start with. And that he crossed an invisible line into alcoholism, and he will, if you ever hear him speak, he will explain that. Now, I didn't cross an invisible line. Start with, I moved the damn line up. Never crossed it. Alcoholics are people that drink in the morning. Up until I drank that morning, then I moved the line, and I didn't know I moved it. Then I knew an alcoholic who couldn't control his body functions very well. And boy, I knew that guy was an alcoholic. And if I ever got that bad, I quit, up until I got that bad. And then it didn't have anything to do with my drinking. There's a world of difference between losing control of your body functions while you're sitting in a bar, like this alcoholic was doing, and when you're home in bed, like I did. I could see the difference. You know, my wife and I had always had a double bed up until that night. You know, they talk about release. She released me that night. She got twin beds. And we've had twin beds. I just did that one night. Just one rotten night, you know. And she treats me like I was doing it every night of my life, for Christ's sake. So we still have twin beds. And I've been sober for 14 years, and it was a traumatic experience for her. That's all you can say. But I wasn't an alcoholic. I was talking to him early, you know, we were talking at dinner, and I was hopelessly in debt. I just couldn't make things work out. I had invented creative financing before the realtors ever dreamed of it. And I just simply ended up not making enough money to make the payments that I had to make. And I had an opportunity to sell some equipment that I didn't own. The equipment that I found right before the owner lost it. Now, some people call that stealing, but that puts a blunt, you know, that puts a sharp edge on it. Anyway, I sold this equipment. I gave it to a guy who was fencing it. And I didn't get any money for it. But you see, I had been able to compromise intellectually whatever integrity and whatever standards of behavior that I had. The book talks about us all having philosophical concepts and moral standards to live by and how that hadn't helped us. And says that several places, and I don't know what rotten page it's on. 46. And that was true about me. I simply didn't have, I couldn't make it work. And it was all right to become a thief. And that weekend, or a weekend after that, I was very, very drunk, and I was trying to line up some more equipment sales in the tattletale. And I wasn't being subtle about it. I was telling them, you know, I worked out here at this factory, and I am receiving inspection, and I've got a lot of equipment I want to sell. You know, and the next day, it was clear to me that I've got to stop drinking because I've blown my cover, you know. The first thing these aerospace companies do is start looking for the drunk anyway, and they start missing equipment, and then they'd found me, and then I'd been in real trouble. I don't know what the hell I thought I was in if it wasn't real trouble. But I knew a guy who's a legend in the tattletale. He was a legend as an alcoholic, and he disappeared about 8 years ago, and we knew that he had become the president of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I called him and asked him if he would take me to an AA meeting. I did not believe I was an alcoholic. And I just knew I had to stop drinking, and that if somehow I went to AA, that would add credibility to the fact that I was going to stop drinking. And he said, that was 11 o'clock in the morning, and he said, "Are you drinking now?" And I said, "No," which was true. I had just finished my half a pint, and I wasn't drinking then. And he said, "Well, okay, but try not to drink anymore." And he said, "If you're drunk, I can't take you to the meeting." And I don't know if I tried or not, but I had two more half a pint. So that by 6:30 I had my life problem in much better perspective, and I didn't know what the hell I'd called Alcoholics Anonymous for, because I wasn't an alcoholic, and I hoped he wouldn't show up. But he did, in this pickup truck, which was just what I expected the president of Alcoholics Anonymous to drive. I knew he wasn't coming in any good car. And I told him I wasn't an alcoholic right off the bat. He said, "I don't know if you're an alcoholic or not, but we're going to the right place." Turned out that he was right. We go to meetings early in Los Angeles. In Southern California, people show up an hour and a half before the meeting and put keys on the chairs, and then they have brawls when somebody takes your keys. But they're serious early, you know, and we went early to the meeting, and I was warmly welcomed. For the first time in my life, I was warmly welcomed, and I was drunk, and I was trying to be funny, and no one was laughing, but they welcomed me. And I could see that they were overlooking my being a jackass, and they were sincerely welcoming me. And I had a feeling, and each one was telling me I was in the right place, in response to my telling each of them that I wasn't an alcoholic. And I had a feeling that maybe I'm in the right place. Maybe that's true. And then they started the meeting there, as they did here tonight, by reading chapter 5. And I'm not sure that it was Oral Roberts, but ever who read chapter 5 sounded a good deal like Oral Roberts. And as he read this with a lot of enthusiasm, the name of this group is my home group, and it's called the Studio Group. That guy really fit in. You know, you'd think he was auditioning for something. And he read this, and he came to this place and said, "There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now." And I knew I was not in the right place. I had discovered that God and I were never in the right place together. Or people who believed that kind of stuff, them and I were not in the right place together. I don't suppose I was ever an atheist, although at one time I would have argued that I was. And I was drunk, and I was reading this. Actually, it's a simple little book that Albert Einstein wrote called The World as I See It. It's nothing technical in the book. And in that book, he talks about the knowledge of something that we cannot penetrate. And that this something, whatever it is, manifests itself in the most profound reason and radiant beauty. And he said, our knowledge of this reason and our emotional experience in response to the profound beauty is a religious experience. And in that sense, he said, I am a deeply religious person in that sense alone. Hell, I'm telling you, if it's good enough for Dr. Einstein, it's good enough for me. But he went on to say that he doesn't believe that he can't conceive of a power that changes things in order to accommodate him and his problems. He said, just enough for me to understand a little of this, be it ever so tiny. And I decided that, you know, that. And I told the guy after the meeting, I said, I'm an alcoholic, because they had defined alcoholism, and they had described alcoholism, and I identified with it. But they had talked incessantly about God also. So when we got in his truck to go home, I said, I'm really an alcoholic, but AA won't help me. I said, if you can con yourself into the fantasy that God is doing things in order to accommodate you and your problems, then living in that fantasy, it'll work. I said, I'm not an atheist, but But God to me is the laws of physics and mathematics, chemistry, and I didn't know anything about any of those laws, but what the hell? I said, you can pray forever and God don't change, but I said, I'll tell you this, you get the Lord's Prayer wrong. I said, it's in earth as it is in heaven. It isn't on earth. And he didn't even care. There I was trying to help him. I said, God, I can't con myself into that fantasy. I have to live in the real world. Which that day probably was 60 bennies and 3 half pints of Old Crow. That was my real world. Never occurred to me that that wasn't the real world. That was certainly my real world. Kenny had read the big book, so he had me at a distinct disadvantage. And he said, boy, it sounds like you've got a good idea about God. He said, makes sense to me. He said, don't worry about that. He said, as far as the program not working for you, when you got in the truck to come to the meeting, the first thing you said was you were not an alcoholic. Now, you've had one meeting, and the first thing you say when you get in the truck to go home is, you are an alcoholic. He said, I can see it's already working for you because that's the first part of the first step. So don't worry about the rest of it. He said, can you not drink tomorrow? And I said, yes, I cannot drink tomorrow. And he said, well, knock off the bennies too. I hadn't even told him I was taking bennies. I don't know how in the hell he knew. Unless he noticed that I said the same thing over and over again real fast. Or that he noticed my tongue was badly blistered from rubbing it against the back of my teeth. But anyway, I didn't drink the next day, and he said we'll go to another meeting. I had a rotten next day, okay? And I had a rotten next evening. My wife wasn't happy with me. I had knocked the stuff figuratively. I'd never hit her in my life. I was smarter than that. But she had lost the stars in her eyes as far as I was concerned, and she didn't have a hell of a lot of hope for anything. So when I got home from work, she was not glad to see me. And Kenny came by and we went to another meeting, and I was warmly welcomed. And the first speaker was very colorful in her language, used all the F and S words, and I loved her. And I got some laughs that night, and I left that meeting and talked to Kenny, and we made arrangements to not drink tomorrow and to go to another meeting tomorrow night. And I had another rotten day the next day. God, I'll tell you, I sure felt terrible. Had another rotten evening when I went home. Went to another AA meeting, and I was warmly welcomed. The speaker that night was dynamite. And he described alcoholism, the first time I had heard the analogy of alcoholism is a train. And if you're on the train is going ultimately to Skid Row, to the hospitals, the mental institutions, and to the cemeteries. If you're on the train, that's where it's going. So along the way, you'll lose your self-respect. You'll lose your integrity. You'll lose every good feeling you've ever had about yourself in your life. You'll lose your job and lose your family and then your sanity. But he said you don't have to go all the way down and lose any of that. You can get off the train at any AA meeting along the way. And if you're here at this one tonight, get off the train and stay off the train. He said some other things that I was just, and this guy was dressed like an old hippie. He was an old hippie. Turned out later on, he and I became very good friends. And he said he had never lost his job and he hadn't lost his home. And I hadn't lost my job and I hadn't lost my home. And I hadn't lost my family, but I was about to. And here this guy had saved all his. I can tell you this, that we became good friends, and I never knew what he did until one night I was watching the Academy Awards, and I found out what he does. He's a motion picture producer of some significant talent and success. And his home is way the hell over in Bel Air, and he lives at the top of the hill, and that didn't have anything to do with anything except he and I were friends, and I would call him and tell him I loved him, and he would call me back and say the same thing. I couldn't get a half of a friendship together in the cattle camp. But anyway, Marvin helped me. It was wonderful to hear him talk. And he also said that he was driving down the freeway one day and spontaneously said, "I love you, God." And he said the most warm, serene feeling. He said, "I have never felt so good in my life." And I believed that that happened. Because he said later on he was feeling kind of rotten and he was driving down the freeway and he purposely slipped it in, "I love you, God," and felt nothing. And I believe that that happened to Marvin. So that was the start of a spiritual awakening. I knew that I wasn't going to do that. That wasn't going to happen to me, but I believed that it happened to Marvin. And I went back to work the next day, had a rotten day at work. Had a rotten day when I went home from work. But we went to another meeting. And I would hear people say, "Go to meetings." And I wondered why in the hell they kept saying that. You know, because when I was in the middle of a rotten day, it never occurred to me to go to meetings. When I went to meetings, I didn't know why I was going. I didn't realize that you were putting me back together every day. That this was the first real respite that really worked that I had. And I'd leave the meeting, I'd feel good. I'd have a feeling of optimism unless I stopped to think. You see, if I stopped to get feeling right in the head by knowing this isn't going to work. And I got laughed at meetings. I had never laughed uncontrollably in my life until I heard some of you guys talk. I heard this one guy who took a lot of Benzedrine and smoked a lot of pot. I just smoked pot twice. But I had the experience that he had every time he spoke. He said the thing about smoking pot is that you don't have to talk to communicate. Because you know what they're thinking, and they know what you're thinking. And all that's necessary is once in a while to say, "Yeah, man." Then he talked about being in the army taking bennies and thinking, "God damn, these guys march slow." There was a gal named Flo D. I love Flo. Flo had a bunch of one-liners. She's a beautiful AA person that was very, very successful in helping people on Skid Row. But Flo talked in her story about a bad period that she had in her life when she lost patience with God and she lost patience with the program. She was still active and she was having a lot of problems. And she shook her fist at 3 o'clock in the morning. She shook her fist in God's face and said, "Why me?" She said this booming voice came to her and said, "Because, Flo, there's something about you that pisses me off." Now, that helped me. You've got to be sick for that to help you, but that helped me. I tell you about sponsorship. I haven't had a sponsor as long as I've been in the program, and to me, that's a special, very special relationship. Someone once asked Mrs. Albert Einstein if she understood the principles of relativity. And after a moment, she said, "Well, no, I don't. But I know my husband, and he can be trusted." In terms of me and my life, I don't know me and my life. I know nothing in and of myself about the principles that I need to live my life by. Not in and of myself, but I know my sponsor, and he can be trusted. Chuck C. says, if you're looking for God, you can't find God. One reason is God's not lost. But he said, you're looking for God, what you're looking for, you're looking with. And if you're hunting him, you can't find him by looking. Now, I know that's true about my character defects. You see, when I was a baby elephant, I was taught to be an analyst. You know, first thing they teach you in school is 1 + 1 is whatever that is. And then as it goes along, they start leaving blank spots in. 1 + x = 2. And the analysis gets, and that becomes part of me. Analyzing the problem becomes part of the way I live my life. And it's an automatic thing, and that sure as hell the way it was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd come to these meetings, and you'd say, work the steps. Well, if working the steps in any way related to any problems I was having, I would have worked them. But the real problems in my life was the nation's economy. Okay? The Vietnamese War, Jane Fonda. My wife and her rotten attitude, you know? And I'm not making those problems up, for Christ's sake. All you gotta do is watch TV, read the newspapers. Those are real problems. Everybody is and should be concerned about them. What the hell's my working the steps going to do with the nation's economy? It was a source of anxiety, and by God, I was anxious. And I could analyze my problem. You know, okay, my first sponsor, I told him about stealing that equipment, and he tracked down the equipment. And he called me and told me where it was and what it would cost me to get it. And he said, this will be your last chance to do it. And if you don't do it, you'll regret it all your life and you might not stay sober. But he left it entirely up to me. He didn't put any other pressure on me. And my wife and I went and borrowed the money and I bought that equipment and I took it back. Now, the next day, I felt good on the net without having taken anything. I felt good about doing that. You see, that resolves the conflict. I could never resolve conflict. Except in my mind, I could rationalize and justify that things were that way and it was all right. I could never sell my stomach on it. And I had this knot in my gut, sometimes called tension, anxiety. I felt good about taking the equipment back, and I knew I felt good. That good feeling eroded away right after I was back at work. I never had a good feeling at work, never had a good feeling at home. I always had a good feeling when I came to a meeting. And sometimes it was better at some meeting, but I always had a good feeling. And I heard a lot of wisdom, and I got a lot of laughter. I'd have anxiety attacks, and I'd call this guy Frank Giroux, and Frank would ask me about the problem. And as I explained my answers to him about this problem, even I could see that this wasn't really a problem after all. And I couldn't tell the difference. And just one girl says in Los Angeles, her sponsor told her she couldn't tell the difference between a hangnail and a death in the family. And boy, I had a lot of that. And I'd tell Frank, and he'd talk me through this problem, and I'd say, God damn, I did it again. What are we going to do with me, Frank? And he'd say, work the steps, and that will surrender you. Does that make sense to any of you when you're new? I don't want to surrender. When I was a baby elephant, I learned that quitters never win and winners never quit. You put your shoulder to the wheel, your nose to the grindstone. There's this big hill and this little bitty train, you know. He says, I think I can. And he chugs right on up because he don't quit. He didn't surrender. I don't want to surrender. And working the steps to surrender, hell, that don't make sense anyway. So I had terrible days. Terrible evening. And on Friday, hell, nothing ever goes wrong on Friday. Good state it. But I wouldn't feel good about Friday. I'd feel like something's going to go wrong. So that was my experience that day. There's another law. It's called the law of probable dispersal. It says that whatever hits the fan will never be distributed evenly. That's also known as the why does it all land on me law. Well, this Saturday morning I was pushing the lawnmower and it hit a tree root and I walked into the lawnmower handle, hurt my chest terribly, and I was absolutely totally enraged at my wife, who wasn't even home.
Why?
Look what she made me do now. And I said to myself, you know, your life isn't getting any better. You know, it's a rotten world and it's always going to be rotten. You can't con yourself into this fantasy. Hell, AA doesn't work. I'm not going to go to no more meetings. I'm not going to drink, but I'm not going to go to any more meetings. That evening, a guy named Clarence came and got me, and by then I'd forgot about not going to go to any more meetings. No, I wasn't going to go. That morning, I remember thinking, I'm not going to go around grinning like a baboon and shaking hands and saying how wonderful it is when it isn't wonderful. And it isn't ever going to be wonderful. That night, halfway to Malibu, I was grinning like a baboon, and we were talking about how wonderful it was, because halfway to Malibu, it was wonderful. And at the meeting, I was warmly welcomed, and Jack Bailey, who by then was a friend of mine, came halfway across the room to greet me and show me his friendship, and I felt good. And Don Gates was the speaker that night, and in his talk, he said, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous and you haven't worked the steps, AA will stop being fun, and you'll decide that you're not going to go to the meetings again. He got my attention. He said, when you decide you're not going to meetings anymore, you'll say, I'm not going to drink, but then later on you'll decide to go back to your tattletale. And if you do that, and old Roger says, what's the matter, Howard? I thought you was going to Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't AA work? Don said, if you haven't worked the steps and they ask you that, I gotta be honest with them and tell them, you don't know if AA works or not because you wouldn't try. That made sense to me. Work the steps and that surrenders you. That doesn't make sense to me. But what Don said made sense. I was thrilled by it. And the second step really took me right then. I came to believe that a power greater than myself, which was these meetings, and I knew the steps would work. I knew that just sitting there, I knew that all I'd done was invalidate them, so I didn't work them. I'd never tried them. And I couldn't believe they wouldn't work unless I tried them. And I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him, and I understood God wasn't going to change anything in order to help me in my problem. I then did an inventory, and I did a good inventory, a remarkably good inventory for somebody that was as screwed up as I was. And you know, I really saw myself, some things about myself that I'd never seen. I was 39 years old before I knew that my dad was not my problem. My dad had been dead for 20 years. And I knew after I'd done my inventory that he wasn't my problem. Whenever anything went wrong, if it wasn't my wife's fault, it was my dad's. And that was really my response to it. I'd gone to a psychologist and paid him good money for him to listen to me about how my dad had beat me. And when we finally spent all our money, he said, you know, your dad was your problem. I said, you really think so? You really think so? I sure wasn't going to be the problem. You know? I did my inventory and I saw I was my problem. It didn't represent a threat to me. I did a fifth step and the sixth step. I did the sixth and seventh step essentially the way it says in the book. Page 75 and 76. I did take the book down from the shelf because I didn't know what to do next. And I took the book down just the way it says. And then I turned to the page that had the first five propositions on it. Page 59. And I did examine each of the first steps. You know, each step in terms of have I purposely cut any corners, am I leaving anything out? And with each of the steps, I had a feeling that nobody else does it this way. That I'm not leaving anything out, and I'm doing it. And when I finished, I had a feeling that I was living up to my commitment. And I didn't, then I took an emotional sounding, and I hadn't changed. See? And I didn't feel any different. And I went to a meeting that night, and I went the next night, and the next night. Wednesday, I was getting ready to go to a meeting, and I was planning on going to a meeting, and after dinner, my wife said, are you going to a meeting again tonight? Well, we've been married for 19 years, and we play this game, and we don't even know we're playing a game. But as soon as she says, are you going to a meeting tonight, I know that she knows that I'm going to a meeting. And what this does is put me in a state of alert. Gets my defenses up so that when she's, I say yes. And she said, well, the kids and I are glad that you're sober. Now I immediately know that she hasn't asked the kids what they think, that this is a prepared talk that she's going to give me. So my defenses are really set. And she said, the kids and I are glad that you're sober and we want you to go to AA, but you're not home any more now than you were when you were drinking. And we need you to help around the house. And you're not here to help. Now I responded by saying, what in the hell are you talking about? Why, I gave her a list of three or four things that I had in fact done around the house. And I presented them as if I had done them recently. And as if these were samples from a hell of a lot longer list that I could give her if I just had the time. Now, her reaction was anger. And she lit into me. And as soon as that happened, my spontaneous response was, I knew all at once that we played the game, that she had wanted to talk to me in a planned, calm way, and that I had shot her right in the foot, and she had gotten mad, and I regretted it, and I felt compassion. And as soon as I could get a word in edgewise, I told her that she was right, that I wasn't getting good enough fast enough, that I'd never be able to make up for the things that I'd done, and I hoped someday she could forgive it and forget it. And I didn't want to argue with her about it, that she was right. And if you want to talk about it some more, we'll do it when I get home from the meeting, but I'm going to go to the meeting. And she didn't want to talk about it anymore. You know, really, all I guess she wanted was me to acknowledge that there was a problem, because there was. Now, that was a remarkable response for me to have, in that it was understanding. I had never experienced understanding before in my life. Hell, I hadn't intended to. I didn't know that there was such a thing. Later on at work, I was hit with a problem that would have stopped an elephant. And all at once, it struck me funny. This was a problem that was going to make me look bad, hurt my career, do all, and it struck me funny. And one of the things about it, what struck me funny, was I had heard Chuck C. say, problems are an opportunity to grow. And I thought that was the dumbest thing I had ever heard a man say. And all at once, I knew that that's true. This isn't, you know, I also knew, and for those of you that are Christians, you know, that Jesus Christ had great spiritual strength. But from my point of view, he had problems. So my sponsor says he had a rough last 2 weeks. And he had all kinds of spiritual strength, and he had problems. It don't have anything to, I knew at the moment that it had nothing to do with me. It's just the way life is. And that struck me funny. Now, there's no way that I can have a real problem that's going to be funny to me. And it happened. And then it dawned on me that I have changed. It wasn't my intention to change. Hell, I had tried to change all my life. I had sworn to my dad and my mom that I was going to turn over a new leaf, that I was going to be different. I'd sworn to the school teachers, to Jesus, to my wife, and I just, by God, couldn't make it stick. All kinds of moral and philosophical beliefs that I couldn't use. And I saw that I was changing, and it hadn't been my intention to change. I'd worked the steps because Don had said, you can't believe they won't work if you... And I didn't know why I was doing it. Didn't know why I was doing it except for that. And my leaf got turned over from working the steps. And it erodes away. It doesn't, you know. But I'll tell you something that hasn't eroded away. When that dawned on me, I experienced faith. I experienced knowing that this thing really works. Nothing in my life has ever worked, and this works. Nothing has happened since then to weaken that faith. Everything that's happened in my life strengthens that faith since that night. And it dawned on me, God didn't have to change anything to accommodate me and my problem. God didn't change it. God didn't have to change anything for the Wright brothers to fly their airplane either. Those principles were always there. All they had to be was discovered. What had to change was I had to change. I had to discover, and not even know I was discovering it, principles, spiritual principles. God isn't, from my point of view, just the laws of physics and mathematics and chemistry, and I'm sure Dr. Einstein knew that. That God is also spiritual principles, which I think for the alcoholic and addict are embodied in these 12 steps. And if we experience those principles, it changes our lives. And the whole world changes. And I can tell you honestly, some of the time I love Jane Fonda now. And the nation's economy is fine, you know. And you can watch TV and read the newspapers, and there's all kinds of stuff in there to have anxiety about, and I don't do it for them. Now, that's an amazing thing. And I still have a lot of the old baby elephant beliefs. I have become basically one of the best second response people that I know. My first response is fear, okay? My second response overrides the fear and, in essence, the tenth step until I can get my act together and I think and see what's really going on rather than what's going on to start with. Now, I have learned to pray and meditate with good effect in my life. And I'm quitting, but I want to tell you this story. I started some time back, well, over 6 years ago, meditating for 30 minutes every morning, and I have not missed over that period of time of 30 minutes of prayer and meditation. And what I do is calm my mind so that I can believe some things that I really believe about the universe. In the big book, bottom of page 48, it said, the prosaic steel girders are made up of electrons that whirl around each other at incredible speeds. And if these things behave that way in accordance with precise law, the scientists tell us this and we have no reason to doubt it. Then it says, the perfectly logical assumption is that underneath the material world and life as we know it, there's an all-powerful, guiding, creative intelligence. I know that every morning. That's the first thing I know in my meditation. That there is no separation between God and I. That this is an underlying intelligence and power that is within all the material world and life as I know it. that there is no separation. God isn't up in heaven behind the pearly, or if he is, he's there, but he's here. And then on page 55 it says, we find that great reality deep down within ourselves. And in the last analysis, it's only there that it can be found, that is so for us. And I know that. I know that when I start my day. And then I try to know some other things that I think are spiritual principles in my life. And on page 83 it says, ask God in your morning meditation to show you the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. Those are real answers to problems. You see, you're not psyching yourself, I'm not psyching myself up into some fantasy. Those are real answers that work when I can experience patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love in the face of a problem. That really solves the problem. Being impatient, intolerant, unkindly, and unloving was always my response, and it never worked. That was a fantasy. That can't work. I'm just going to drink a half of this, half a pint. That's a fantasy. That can't work. Patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love can. I've always believed when the light turns green, we get to go. That's a baby elephant belief I have. Red means we stop. This one morning, I had gone through my meditation, and I had known that today, in planning my day, I had planned to be patient, tolerant, kindly, and loving at work. I got in the car, I came to the first stoplight. Now, normally, when the light turns green, you have 3 milliseconds to get the hell out of my way. And then I think, that's as green as that light's going to get. Why is he still sitting there? This morning, there were two black guys in the car in front of me, and the light turned green, and they just sat there, and spontaneously, my first reaction was one of patience, and it was all right. And I started having a good feeling. And it came, when it started up through my spine, I knew I was having a great feeling, and it was all right, we could sit there all day. Then they noticed the light had changed, and they pulled out and turned left, and the guy waved back at me apologetically. And when I gave him the high sign, I had goosebumps all over my arm. I felt wonderful. Just from a spontaneous experience of patience. And I was powerful that week. I'm telling you, it was a week eroding away. It was a wonderful, wonderful week. And God didn't have to change anything for that to have happened to me. I fell in love with that idea, and that's the way I want to live my life. Now, I don't live my life, you know, that doesn't happen to me that often. But it happens to me as a first response. That's the way I want to live my life, and the only avenue for me to find that is right here. There is no other way, and I don't want to find any other way. This is the old... Who wrote about Don Juan and the Yaqui way of life, Carlos Castaneda. He says, if you're on the path, he said, paths don't go anyplace. And that's true. You know, wherever you go, there you are. You're the first one to get there. Paths don't go anyplace. But if you're on a path, he said, stop and ask yourself alone, is there love on this path? Does this path have a heart? And if it doesn't, then that path is of no use. But if it does, you're there, because the path isn't going anyplace anyway. But if you're experiencing love, there's no need to go anyplace else. I ask myself, and I ask myself alone, does the path of Alcoholics Anonymous have a heart? Is there love on this path? I know there is. That's my personal experience. I know that anyone that opens themselves to this will find that that's true, because we live love in Alcoholics Anonymous. We will go to any length to help each other live a sober, comfortable life. We don't just say we love you. That's the way we live our lives. I love you. I know that you love me. I thank you very much for letting me share.